Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Aspirissim Bobby Ghosh, who is Time Magazine's senior correspondent, who has broken a major story published in Time Magazine regarding the massacre of 15 Iraqi civilians, including 5 children, in the western Iraqi town of Haditha. It's been alleged that these killings were committed by the United States Marines in what some are calling Iraq's My Lai Massacre. And we were looking into that burgeoning and deeply embarrassing story. We'll then talk with Belinda Reyes, who's an assistant professor and founding faculty at the School of Social Sciences, Humanities and Arts at the University of California in Merced. She was formerly a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and her research focuses on immigration issues and the economic progress of race and ethnic groups in the United States. And of course, we'll be talking to her in the context of the extraordinary and unprecedented demonstrations here yesterday in Los Angeles, where 500,000 people took to the streets in downtown Los Angeles. There was also about 50,000 plus in Denver, and on Saturday, demonstrations in Phoenix and Atlanta, and a couple of weeks ago, a demonstration of about 120,000 people in Chicago, demonstrating against the Sensenbrenner House bill and the Kyle Senate bill. And we'll be talking about the manifestation of a powerful vocal Latino voting bloc in this forthcoming elections, and the extent to which it is dividing the Republican Party and perhaps to a lesser extent the Democratic Party. And then we'll talk about the Democratic Party and its conflict between the Republican Light faction and the insurgent Progressive faction. We'll be speaking with Marcos Melitzis, along with Jerome Armstrong. They've written a new book, Crashing the Gate. And we're talking to both the authors of this book about their notion that netroots and grassroots could capture the Democratic Party and engineer a victory from the grassroots in the 06 and 08 elections. I'm now speaking with Aspirissim Bobby Ghosh, who is a Time Magazine senior correspondent who's just arrived back from a long stint in Baghdad. He has covered the Iraq War since the winter of 2002, 2003, and he is also reported from Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. He originally joined Time magazine in 1997 as a senior editor for Time Asia, and he has come across, in fact, we'll be talking about that, what is called the Haditha tapes, which were video evidence of the death of a number of Iraqi civilians, 15 Iraqi civilians, including 5 children, in the western town of Haditha. And, of course, there is an NCIS investigation into these killings, and some are calling this incident Iraq's My Lai Massacre. Bobby Ghosh, is that hyperbole, or do you think that's a fitting description?
Well, I would stop short of describing it as a My Lai Massacre until the investigation is complete. It certainly has the potential to be a scandal of that scale. We know now without any doubt, because the first investigation has shown that the Marines did indeed kill these people, non-combatants, at least 15 of them were innocents. What we do not yet know, and the NCIS investigation is meant to find that out, is the motives behind the killings, whether these were collateral damage, whether these people were killed by accident, or whether the Marines were extracting revenge for the killing of one of their own. If the latter proves to be the case, then we have a My Lai on our hands.
And how did you come across the so-called Haditha tapes, which I understand were filmed by a young Iraqi journalist?
A journalist student, yes. It was a stroke of luck for us. In Baghdad, we're always hearing about accusations of atrocities on the part of Americans, and I should point out that 99% of them are always false. And they're also very hard to prove, because evidence is hard to get. It's difficult to get to these places because they're so dangerous. With Haditha, we lucked out. We had a young journalism student who took videotape in the immediate aftermath of the carnage, and then was able to get that videotape into the hands of a human rights group, which brought it to us.
And can you walk us through what you know about this incident?
Well, here's what we know for certain happened. On the morning of the 19th of November, early morning, a four Humvee patrol of American Marines was going through the town when it was hit by an IED, an improvised explosive device, by the side of the road. The IED destroyed one Humvee and killed one Marine. The Marines say after that that they received small arms fire from houses in the neighborhood. They returned fire, they entered those houses, and in the process of clearing those houses, they killed a number of people, including the people killed outside and inside the houses. We're talking about 24 dead. Initially, the Marines claimed that all of the people were killed by the IED. That's what they told us. And when we confronted them with reports that their soldiers might have killed some people, they got very hostile. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. It was only when we had the videotape in hand that we could be absolutely sure that a number of people were killed by gunfire, not by shrapnel or not by the explosives. We then brought the videotape to the attention of higher authorities in Baghdad, and they launched an investigation, a two-step investigation. The first step has been completed, and as I said, it proved that these people were killed by the Marines. The second step, the NCIS investigation, is currently underway, and that will determine whether the rules of war were broken, whether the Marines acted in a malign and hostile fashion.
Well, now, is there any evidence that civilians are used as watches, if you will, to trigger IEDs?
Well, none that I have come across. Civilians are often used as shields, and this is a sad fact of war in Iraq, that the bad guys, the terrorists or insurgents, who call them what you will, they hide behind civilians, they hide in civilian homes, and they bring the civilians into harm's way. And let's not forget that the insurgents have absolutely no compunctions about killing civilians if that suits their purpose. I believe that is all the more reason why it is essential that the military conduct this investigation in a transparent and clear fashion, so that the Iraqis can be persuaded that while the terrorists are willing to kill innocents and then boast about it, when that happens at the hands of the Marines, the military takes it seriously and makes sure that justice is done. The difference between the good guys and the bad guys can often be blurred in a war like this, but I think a good investigation and then punishment for those responsible will help establish that the Marines are indeed the good guys in this case.
But I imagine this is the last thing that the brass wanted to hear about, right? After Abu Ghraib and the ongoing the rendition scandals,
that is correct. I'm sure this is a very inconvenient incident for the brass, but I think they should seize upon this as an opportunity rather than as something to wipe under the carpet. I mean, their first reaction, as I said, was hostile, and they accused us of buying into enemy propaganda, and that's a bad start when you try to cover up something. And I hope that this investigation can undo some of the damage that was done by that bad start.
And Bobby Ghosh, since you've been in Baghdad for since 2002 with Time magazine and obviously covering the war in depth, and you've broken this important story, what is your sense of the morale of the soldiers, given that they've been given this difficult mission that the American people, according to the polls, less and less support in the growing majority? That's got to undercut them to some extent, and they are, from what I can understand, in a very difficult situation with an elusive, often invisible enemy, and a very, very fuzzy mission.
I couldn't agree more, and morale is very low. This is, again, something that the military does not want to admit. If they are conducting studies into troop morale, they are not sharing that information with us. Just anecdotally, having encountered soldiers and been embedded with soldiers from the beginning, in fact, from before the war, I can tell you that the soldiers I see nowadays, many of whom are veterans, are coming back for their second or third tour of duty in Iraq, their morale is quite low, and they're actively aware that the war is growing unpopular back home, and many of them question the sacrifices that they are themselves making. Now, they're soldiers, they're professionals, they follow orders, They do the duty, the vast majority of them, to the best of their ability. But they are also human beings, and it hurts when they hear that people back home are beginning to turn against the war, just as they did with Vietnam.
And if it's true that these young Marines exacted a revenge killing from having one of their comrades killed by an IED, that, of course, is not an example of professionalism. And without trying to excuse their alleged behavior, nevertheless, you can get the sense that these young soldiers are traumatized, and if they did what they did, they're damaged for life, surely.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if the accusations that are being brought by the local people and by the human rights group, if the accusations are true, then these are certainly people who have no business being in uniform, bearing arms in any environment, much less a hostile foreign country. What we know is that the unit that was involved in this incident is still in the Haditha area on active duty until this investigation is concluded. So that makes it even more important that the investigation is swift and thorough and transparent.
And are you confident that that will happen, given what happened with Pat Tillman in Afghanistan? Pat Tillman being a football hero who gave up a lucrative career to become a special forces soldier and was killed by friendly fire. And there were three separate investigations, and the Pentagon lied shamelessly in all. And now there is a possibility of a murder charge being brought against somebody in the military.
That is very disheartening, and it does not bode well for this investigation. But, you know, one can only hope that the military learns with every example of attempts to sweep things under the carpet going badly wrong. One can only hope that they will, this time, get it right. The NCIS has been brought in. As I understand, the NCIS has a very good record in these matters. And I guess one should trust them to live up to their record.
And just in broadening out a little bit, Bobby Goshen, in terms of the broader picture, as I mentioned earlier, polls indicate a growing majority of Americans want out of Iraq. And it, even though the Democrats haven't created a narrative, or in effect, Bush's mistake is, to some extent, appears to be their problem. Jack Murtha and others have called to withdraw. And there's also the portent of a civil war, which has been discussed in the press since the bombing of the mosque in Samarra. And in fact, it's hard to imagine what it'd be like being a patriotic young American fighting for a democracy in a country that appears not to want, certainly they don't want America's help. And here we have the spiritual leader, who's, in fact, an Iranian, Sistani, just calling for the execution of lesbians and gays. So it's hard to see the notion of building a constitutional democracy in this bloody environment.
Well, it is very hard, and you're right. There is a civil war already afoot. May not be the kind of civil war that we would recognize, but people are being killed for being Shiite or Sunni, and that's at a rate of anywhere between 50 and 100 a day, and that sounds very much like a civil war to me. Will they have a constitutional democracy? I believe that the vast majority of Iraqis who are moderate people do want it. They don't necessarily want a democracy like the United States, though. They don't necessarily want a democracy where there are the gays have people have rights, or where the democracy like we know it here. They will. It's also a little unrealistic to take a society that is so deeply conservative and fling it willy-nilly into the 21st century. I think they need a certain amount of adjustment period so that they can come to terms with what this idea of democracy is. And it, while the rest of the world still has some influence in that country, it is possible, although increasingly difficult, to nudge them towards an internationally accepted form of democracy. At the moment, they want the right to vote. They want the right to vote in their government. That is a big step forward from what they had before. And let's not forget that.
Well, just in terms of the Civil War portent, Bobby Ghosh, today apparently mortar rounds were lobbed into Muqtada al-Sadr's compound, and he, of course, is a popular militia leader who took on the Americans some time back, and his statue was elevated as a result of that. And the Shiite side has a number of other militias, the Badr Brigade among them, along with the Muqtada's Mahdi Army. Clearly, the people who lobbed those mortar bombs might well be the same people who blew up the Samarra Mosque. So it does seem that on the...
it might be people who whose own were killed by Muqtada's militias. There are lots of different groups at work in Iraq, and many of them are provoking the others into a fight. There's no scarcity of radical voices. Muqtada's is one, and probably the most prominent. There are many different versions of extremism at play in that country. The sad part of it is that there's very few credible voices of moderation. Most of the politicians, although they are new to the game, are already thoroughly discredited. There are very few leaders who can rise above their petty and narrow sectarian and tribal interests. This is a country that desperately needs a Mandela, a Nehru, or a Gandhi. I know it's impossible to will such a person to emerge, but this country desperately needs a unifying figure of that order, but sadly doesn't have one. And from all the people that I have met, there doesn't seem to be anybody emerging of that stature.
And just in closing then, Bobby Ghosh, it seems to me that it's just a matter of time before the Shiites take the bait. If they are being provoked in a serial manner by either Ba'athist rejectionists or Al-Qaeda clones, I find it personally mystifying as to what is restraining them. I believe the Iranians are urging them to show restraint, but I just think at a certain point they're going to take the bait.
Well, you're absolutely right. What has restrained them so far is the knowledge that the democratic process works in their favor. They have spoken in two elections and a referendum. They have shown their strength. They have more to gain from stability than from instability. They are clinging on to the hopes that as long as their kind or their fellow co-religionists are running the country, they will have the upper hand. What's happened more recently is that they're beginning to realize that just having control in Baghdad is not enough, and that although there might be a Shiite-led government in charge of the country, that government is incapable of providing the Shiites the security that they need. And that is now driving the Shiites towards radical militia leaders like Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Bobby Ghosh. And are you going back, by the way?
Yes, I will. I'll be going back at the end of April.
And is that... I mean, it's got to be the scariest assignment there is. The impression that compared to Vietnam, Saigon was an open city compared to Baghdad.
That is true, Ian. But then there is also... You understand this, a sort of innate journalistic curiosity. I was there before the story started, and I have a need to find out how the story turns out. And we also have a very large number of Iraqi colleagues who work for Time magazine there, and I am increasingly concerned about their safety and the well-being of their families, and that is another thing that brings me back to Baghdad.
Again, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Bobby Ghosh.
Anytime, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Bobby Ghosh, who is a Time magazine senior correspondent. He's just back from a long stint in Baghdad. He's been there since the winter of 2002, and he has broken this story that may well be an explosive addition to the Abu Ghraib story, and that is that 15 Iraqi civilians, including 5 children, were allegedly massacred by Marines in the western Iraqi town of Haditha. Bobby Ghosh got hold of videotape evidence that suggested that these people were shot, not blown up by an IED, as was alleged, and that many people are calling this incident Iraq's My Lai massacre. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Belinda Reyes, who's an assistant professor and founding faculty at the School of Social Sciences, Humanities and Arts at the University of California, Merced. Formerly, she was a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and she has been working on border issues and the broader issue of immigration. And clearly, Belinda, there's a massive stirring within the Latino populations here in the United States, with 500,000 people taking to the streets yesterday in Los Angeles and in Denver, about 50,000, I believe. And on Friday, there was about, I believe, 20,000 in Phoenix demonstrated in front of the offices of Senator John Kyle. Similar demonstrations in Atlanta, and a couple of weeks ago, about 120,000 people took to the streets of Chicago to demonstrate against the Sensenbrenner Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, in the Chicago demonstration, there was a quite heavily featured were Mexican flags, and then yesterday's Los Angeles demonstration, they're much less. Everybody's wearing white T-shirts and more American flags. And I guess that gets to the real question here: is in political terms, I believe 62% or 61% of the American people are against illegal immigration and want some kind of laws, but the Republican Party are in a real dilemma, and they see this as an issue that could hurt them. And I suppose it's also equally, well, not, perhaps not equally, but an issue that can hurt the Democrats. So how do you separate out the politics from the policy?
It's hard. It's very hard because it's also an election year, and people are positioning themselves based on aspirations for presidential positions, and also wondering about, you know, Congress and being able to be reelected. So it's difficult at this point. I mean, I think it's also a very difficult point. It reminds, in a way, of welfare reform during the Clinton administration. That is a Democratic president kind of advocating issues that sound a little bit more Republican in a way. So there's probably more division among the Republicans than around the Democrats. If anything, the Democrats are asking for more comprehensive policies, while the Republican Party is divided on guest worker programs versus just border controls. So it kind of is a different moment in terms of immigration policy, because of the politics are very different now.
But it does seem that in our last conversation, I found it very interesting, some of the ideas that you are putting forward, and mm-hmm. and I don't see any of this being discussed in the broader debates, whether it's on the more bombastic side with Lou Dobbs on CNN,
mm-hmm.
or in terms of the demonstrators, the 500,000 here in the streets of Los Angeles, and that is that a more intelligent and a benign way to approach this issue would be to decriminalize the whole issue. And if you could decriminalize the issue, meaning that people who cross the border would not have to put their lives in the hands of criminals who charge them thousands of dollars to sneak across the border, and these are the same people that bring in drugs and whatever other contraband. I'm just wondering, is there any traction for that notion that if you decriminalize it and mean that everybody that's here can go back and forth once they are documented?
Mm-hmm. The Bush administration is making similar arguments in terms of security, and some of the Democrats are making similar arguments that this would be better for security purposes, because
right.
the flow would not be workers. You could create an avenue for that to come in as guest workers or legal immigrants, and then the only people that you will have to protect and the border will have to be checking are the criminals.
Exactly. It would make the job of Homeland Security infinitely easier.
Yeah.
If there wasn't this notion of a border in terms of dividing people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if there was a secure border, and I recently interviewed the former head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. He wrote a couple of books under the title of Anonymous. Mm-hmm. He made the point that the two biggest security issues in his mind, given that he spent years and years chasing Bin Laden, mm-hmm. was the two biggest issues after 9/11 in his mind were to secure Soviet nuclear material, mm-hmm. which the Bush administration has backed off on some of the programs that they've had with the Russians, and to find out who's in the country. So if you legalized the people that were here, and then you'd actually have an inventory, because the point he was making is that we simply don't know who's in the country. And you can see that doubt would feed the paranoia of the more hawkish constituencies in this country.
Yeah, and if you make it, in fact, some of the proposals now, the one that went through the House and the one being proposed by Fritz in the Senate, it's to make it a criminal act, a felony, to just be here working illegally.
Right.
That makes it even worse. So we've filled up the jails with people that just came here to work.
Well, that shows you how dysfunctional it is there, because if they ever exercised that notion that if you were illegal and you crossed in and were caught, mm-hmm. that you would therefore have committed a felony and therefore they would be obliged to jail you, mm-hmm. well, let's face it, the jails would be overflowing in a week.
Exactly.
And so it's a kind of hollow gesture, it seems. Again, I just wonder if anybody is really dealing with this seriously or whether it's just...
Yeah. I mean, again, some Democrats are making that point, that really to really address the security, and the Bush administration as well, that to deal with the security issue, you have to do what you're saying. You have to legalize the people that are here, and you have to know who's here and encourage people to, you know, come to the surface. And then you also have to create a flow, some guest worker program for the people that are coming in as workers to, you know, enter in some other way. And then you could be more secure that way.
And I guess just to add to your argument, if you decriminalized this situation, which, you know, again, you could use the analogies of the war on drugs, mm-hmm. That you just keep spending more and more good money after bad and you get nowhere. And the idea of spending billions on a fence is kind of exemplifies this kind of mindset. If you were to be a little more enlightened and to decriminalize it, that would mean that people would be able to cross and visit families much more regularly. Mm-hmm. Already, there's a tremendous amount of remittance of money, and I believe something like 1 in 10 Mexican citizens live in the United States. So do you think that if they were to adopt this more enlightened approach, would we find, in fact, that the flow of immigration would slow down, that people would want to spend more and more time in their home country?
Yeah. The sense is that the border enforcement, in fact, is making people stay here longer, and it's making people less likely to do that visiting and going back and forth. And, you know, and it's separating families from longer and many of these things. And the problem, too, is that, I mean, and it is not a problem. We don't want to just say that we just want these guest workers because, you know, I think some people come with the idea of working, they become very productive members of society, they may marry, and there should also be a process for them to regularize. That's some of the arguments that the Democrats are making. That it shouldn't be just a guest worker program that you come here for 2 years or 3 years and then you have to go back. That there's a portion of them that would settle. And, you know, we create roots, and there should be a mechanism to allow productive members of society to remain long-term in the country. So I think most would end up going back, and most would end up very content with a guest worker-type program, but there should be some sort of regularization process that people could change their status and remain long-term.
And what about those arguments that on the conservative side that amnesty and a guest worker program would reward lawbreakers?
The problem is also our visa process. I mean, for some countries, it could take a decade for people to be separated from their families. So in some cases, families are having to choose between work and family. And is that, and I think that's in fact what the Bush administration says, family values should not end, you know, south of the border. That if we truly believe in family reunification, we also need to address the issues of our visa process. And for some countries, it's Philippines, Mexico, many Central American countries, it takes forever for people to be able to be reunited with their families. So addressing that issue of you know, how long it takes for that process and all the problems of processing of the INS that we know many times, paperwork is lost and people spend a lot of money. Then, you know, you could think about this. And what, for example, the Kennedy-McCain proposal had was that people had to be here for 6 years before they're able to even be readjust their status. That is about as long as it takes for the backlog to go through. So their argument was that they wouldn't be jumping over anybody, that they it would take about as long as it takes as they were applying at home. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they will be working here.
Well, just in closing then, what is, I mean, obviously somebody suggested where it's carrying American flags as opposed to Mexican flags, which was, there was a lot of backlash from the Chicago demonstrations a couple of weeks ago because of the number of Mexican flags. And there is a constituency of people who believe, I believe it's in the Aslan theory, which I don't understand its historical roots. So what's going on in that side? Is there much traction inside the immigrant community for this more kind of romantic, ahistorical notion that this place was always Mexico, so what's the border about any rate?
Yeah, I don't think that's an important issue within the for, at least I haven't heard major people advocating we're taking over and, you know, this, we want to turn into Aztlán and this is returning to our, you know, Mexican heritage. It's really more, I think, a statement of a presence of a population that should not be ignored. So I think it was the message of there's many Latinos and many Mexicans here, and, you know, let's pay attention to this population that in many cases have been ignored. So it's not a message of we want to take over. It's a message of we're here and we want to be here as citizens and as legal persons, not as invisible people.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. Belinda Reyes, who's Assistant Professor and Founding Faculty of the School of Social Science, Humanities, Arts at the University of California, Merced. She's also was a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and is specialized in border and immigrant issues. And we're talking about the unprecedented demonstrations in the last few days throughout the United States in favor of a more humane immigration policy and against the Republican Sensenbrenner and Kyle Bills in the House and Senate, respectively. Let's now go to the subject of an insurgency within the Democratic Party crashing the gate. I'm speaking with Marcus Melitzis and Jerome Armstrong, the co-authors of Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Marcus, you founded the Daily Kos in May of 2002. That gets about 1 million hits a day, making it one of the most popular blogs in the nation. And clearly your book is an attempt to take back the Democratic Party in terms of grassroots. You also point out in your book that the Republicans don't know how to govern, but they know how to win elections. In 1994, Newt Gingrich, with the Contract for America, wiped out the Democrats in the House, and there's an expectation that there may be a similar event happen in 2006 in spite of the fact that the Democrats don't have any kind of contract. So why is it, therefore, that they haven't? I understand that Rahm Emanuel's been working on some kind of manifesto. Why is it that the Democratic Party keeps waiting for the man on the white horse, the perfect candidate, at the same time they don't generate any kind of manifesto?
Well, this is, I mean, you're not going to win an election with a manifesto. At the end of the day, it takes a lot more than just a fancy slogan and a couple items and a couple ideas on a piece of paper to get people to vote for your party. This is why we wrote the book, because we've seen what the right has done. They built this incredible idea machine to generate their ideas and to refine them and to sell them and to create a governing blueprint from those ideas. They created this media machine in order to promote their and market their ideas to the American public. And they created the campaign infrastructure to be able to actually sell those ideas. And in politics, obviously, you sell your ideas in an election. we don't have that. So we can have the fanciest and schnazziest slogan coming in and our own manifesto, and it really does no good. And that's why we actually wrote this book, because we were really upset at the fact that despite the constant losing, the Democratic establishment really hadn't come to terms with the reasons why it was not winning.
And you don't think it's a they can borrow from the Republican playbook, given what you just said, that it's not just a manifesto, it's an whole organization. It's taken them, what, 20 years to develop. Where is the equivalent plan on the Democratic side?
The Democrats are not losing as bad as the Republicans did in at the time when that was when the Republicans were on the insurgents. It's not that the Democrats have to make up as much ground as the Republicans did 30 or 40 years ago. They're close. They're just not over the top.
I see. Well. Given that the president is a polarizing figure, and he has largely satisfied the far right while energizing the far left, I get the impression that what's coming up in 06 is that for the first time in American politics, you know, both parties have always gravitated to the center. That's where they've tried to harvest their votes. It seems to me that we're in a polity now where the whole center is up for grabs.
You think that both parties have gravitated towards the center?
No, I'm saying that they all, in the generals and in the most elections, they try and fight over the soccer moms, over the center. And the impression I get now is that the center is up for grabs.
Absolutely. The Republicans have completely decided that the way they are going to win elections is by motivating their base, and so they have been very, very effective at it. I'm not one of these people who really thinks that the center really turns out the vote. They don't. John Kerry actually won the center in 2004, for all the good it did him, obviously. We are at an age and an era where partisanship really, really helps, and Republicans are absolutely masterful at motivating their base to turn out and vote, and Democrats are not. And that's why I actually am very pessimistic about this fall. I think Democrats may make some gains out of default, but given the troubles that the Republicans are in, just the corruption and the inability to govern effectively, I would assume that a competent opposition party could ride that into majorities in both houses of Congress. I'm not seeing that, because the Democrats are content to sit back, and they expect people to vote for them because the Republicans are really bad. What I'm seeing is our people are just tuning out of politics. They're saying, well, the Democrats aren't speaking to me, and the Republicans are a disaster. I'm just going to sit this one out.
Well, indeed, it's always mystified me as to why the issue upon which Bush is most vulnerable, and this goes back to 2004, the Iraq War, for some reason or other, that's been off the table. It was off the table with Kerry, and still the Democratic Party hasn't figured out a narrative on the war, even though there are the so-called fighting Democrats running this time. So how is it that George Bush's mistake became the Democrats' problem?
Well, the Democrats haven't drawn a distinction with George Bush over that issue. In the 2004 election, when John Kerry stood before the Grand Canyon and said that he would vote for the same way regardless of knowing everything he knew, you know, leading up, that there was no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever, the Bush camp was actually their happiest at that point, because they knew at that time that the whole issue was off the table.
And
Now, why, you know, if you ask why Democrats aren't making that distinction,
right,
it goes to these consultants. In D.C., they're risk-averse. They think, well, if we neutralize their advantages, and they still continue to internalize this notion that Democrats are weak on national security and Republicans are strong, so no matter how bad Bush and the Republicans may be screwing up the war on terror and screwing up Iraq, they still think they need to stay quiet about it, because that's the way to, quote, neutralize it, and they hope that people will turn out and vote on other issues.
And what they're hoping to do is go after that invisible center group, but they don't show up in the polls, and especially in midterm elections. Midterm elections are about getting out your base. That's what the Republicans did in 1994. They got their base fired up, who then went out and got four or five other people to the polls as well. And that's what Democrats really need to try to do this midterm.
And so the professional election losers like Bob Schrum, that you talk about in your book, Crashing the Gate, Net Roots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Again, I'm speaking with Marcus Melitzis and Jerome Anderson, the co-authors of this new book, which I believe is being published tomorrow. And how do you account for somebody like that? What is his record, 8-0?
Yeah, it's Yeah, 8-0
I'm sorry.
I wish it was 8-0.
Yeah,
and what's more,
showing my ignorance of American sports. I'm
right,
sorry.
Right. And what's really ironic is that he actually worked the Jimmy Carter presidential campaign for a few weeks or months, and then quit in disgust because of the direction that campaign was going. And ironically, that was the one race, if he would have stuck with, he would have actually been a winner. Although I would argue that maybe that campaign was a winner because Bob Schrum left it in disgust. So it's an old boys' network. It's what we call the Beltway Mafia. These consultants run the party, and it's musical chairs. One year they're working as a consultant, the next year they're working as the head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. The next year they're running as a head of a 527 organization, a political action committee, and then the next year they're back as a consultant. And so they all know each other, and they all move business into each other's hands, and nobody outside his little clique can get a piece of the action. So they are self-perpetuating. They are losers. Clearly, they are losers, objectively speaking. And nobody, none of these people, and we went out to the States and we talked to consultants who are doing good work out in the States, and they cannot break into D.C. because of this mafia. So instead of pulling in the talent, the people who are winning, they are completely shutting everybody out so they can essentially profit from the political system. Whether they win or lose is irrelevant to them.
So give us a sense then of your plan to circumvent the professional losers and to take a leaf out of Howard Dean's book, although he's become a part of the party now, take back the country via the grassroots.
Well, the idea here is to get inside the gate and change the strategy that the Democrats are running their elections and campaigns are. Instead of the whole battleground mentality, which people like Bob Schrum go about, where they pinpoint all the resources on, you know, one state or one race and just try to barely get enough. The idea is to battle the Republicans everywhere, and that's, you mentioned Howard Dean, sort of in line with his whole 50-state strategy. And what we talk about is every Republican coming in the House and in the Senate having a Democratic opponent that's fighting them.
But what is, given that we have the professional election losers that have been running the party from Washington, and then you have at the grassroots, you've mentioned it earlier, both Marcos and Jerome, the disquiet, putting it politely, if the base is alienated and frustrated with the party, alienation and frustration isn't a good ticket to run on.
No, absolutely not. One of the things we want to see more of is people working in their local districts actually taking matters into their own hands and backing those candidates that the party says have no chance to win. Our perfect example of that was Paul Hackett running in a special election in Ohio, a Cincinnati area congressional district, very, very Republican. And the party took a look at the seat and said, yeah, we're not interested. Bush won his district with 63% of the vote. And so essentially, the grassroots in the district and the netroots nationally mobilized on behalf of Paul Hackett, and we came within 2 points of winning this race. Now, I was particularly glad because Paul Hackett ran a very aggressive campaign. He criticized George Bush. He criticized the war. He was an Iraq War veteran. And had we had the party come in and these election consultants, these loser consultants come in, they would have said, Bush got 63% of the vote here. You cannot criticize George Bush. You cannot criticize the war. You cannot be negative. You have to speak more like a Republican and sound like a Republican. And maybe you'll fool people into thinking that you're really not a Democrat in the ballot box, and they'll vote for the Democrat instead of the Republican. And, of course, that's not how things work. And we saw it in Ohio, in this Ohio special election, where these very conservative people said, you know, we're sick and tired of what's going on nationally. We're sick and tired of George Bush screwing things up and of the war. And thus, they voted for Paul Hackett. But that's because he gave them an actual choice between the Republican and the Democrat. And that's what we need to see more of.
And as you point out in your book, the liberal blogosphere funded $500,000 out of the $850,000 that Hackett spent against Mean Gene Schmidt, who, as you mentioned, just squeaked by in a safe district. But you have to tell the rest of the story, surely. What happened to Paul Hackett? I mean, here he is, one of the most electable candidates the Democrats have, and he's not running. I mean, he was originally going to run in the Senate, and then they asked him to pull out, and he can't run in the House.
Well, there are, you know, I believe very strongly in primaries. I think that's a place where people can decide what direction they want the Democratic Party to go in. Now, like anything else, you're going to have the party trying to clear the field, and they had a great progressive in Sherrod Brown running for Senate as well. And they asked Paul Hecht to drop out, and he used that as an excuse to drop out. Now, there are many, many contested races happening this cycle and all over the country, and in every single one of them, the party's telling one or the other candidate, please step out. And these insurgent candidates or these non-establishment candidates stick with it. So Paul Hackett, I think, realized that in a special election, he raised all his money online. And he didn't have to dial for dollars. And in a congressional race, you don't need to raise as much money as in a Senate race. And he realized that this was really, really tough. It's mind-numbingly boring. I mean, I think it's soul-sucking work to sit on the phone for 8 hours a day begging people for money. It's one of the big problems with our democracy. And I think it affects people like Hackett, who are more genuine type of candidates but don't want to spend 8 hours a day calling and begging for money. So I think he just finally, that's what knocked him out of the race, not because somebody asked him, oh, please drop out of the race, and he, you know, an Iraq War veteran, a hero, is going to decide that, oh, my God, I can't stand somebody asking me to drop out, so I'm going to quit. I mean, that does not make sense. To me, I think he just realized that the process was extremely difficult in a bad way, not a difficult, like a nice challenge, but in a soul-sucking sort of way, and that's why he dropped out.
So I don't mean to hop on it, but I'm puzzled as to why, for example, he doesn't run against Jean Schmidt again, because she self-destructed after her squeak through victory. With that shameful display on the House floor, calling Jack Mercer a coward.
Absolutely. I mean, in my perfect world, he would have ran again for that Ohio congressional seat. He would have won, and Sherrod Brown would have won the Senate race. And then in 4 years, we have Mike DeWine, who's going to run Voinovich. Is going to run for re-election in 2010, and then Paul Hackett would have been a great candidate to take on Voinovich. So that would have been the way I would have done it, but he's not me.
Let's talk about another candidate now who's, I think, pretty much got his toe in the water, Russ Feingold, who proffered the censure motion, and the party establishment is running from him. What's going on there? Is it because they think he's grandstanding, he's running for the president, or is it perhaps that that the NSA issue is not quite as strong as an issue as, for example, the Iraq War is?
Well, Jerome's a little quiet now because he actually works for Mark Warner.
And I work for Sherrod Brown.
So I get to field these questions because I can be the impartial observer.
Yeah, I definitely would not be.
I think what we're seeing is I think part of the reason why Democrats are not running to Feingold's side partly is because he didn't really give them a heads up that this was coming. And there's certain collegiality rules in the Senate, and especially for something this explosive. So I think that's part of it. But also, I think these Democrats in D.C. are so paranoid of doing anything that'll potentially shake things up, because they think that just by existing and by breathing air and being alive, that they're going to win, they're going to make big gains in November. So anything that might stir the pot a little bit freaks them out. And we heard this from Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, who said things are going so well for Democrats right now. Why does he want to speak up like this and potentially damage us? When I don't think things are going that great for Democrats right now. Things are going poorly for Republicans, but I don't think that really translates to specifically things are going great for Democrats.
And so they can't take comfort out of standing on the sidelines while the other guy shoots himself in the foot. Let me ask you then about the do you believe, either of you believe, that going progressive and winning over the center are mutually exclusive? I mean, why should they be mutually exclusive?
No, I think if you look at any of the polls, that the positions that Democrats are taking on the issues are what are in the majority. So it's clear that we have the people on our side with the progressive agenda. What the problem is in terms of execution of the election strategy for the Democrats. What the Republicans realized is, this came out of the Goldwater election, was that they were firmly rejected for their ideas by the majority of the people. And so what they've done is execute a strategy of selling those ideas that's, you know, all based upon trickery of the people. And what Democrats need to do is to get their machine in order, get their candidates and consultants in order, and they can win these elections.
But the polls have indicated that the American people are actually much less conservative than they appear in many ways. They do support liberal ideas, but they don't have the comfort zone to abandon the crude certainties of the Limbaughs and O'Reillys and Hannitys for a more nuanced truth. And it does seem that given that the president and the Christian radicals have captured the party and moved to the far right, that there's an awful lot of Republicans who are upset with fiscal irresponsibility, corruption, cronyism, illegal immigration, environmental neglect, you name it. So again, I get the impression that there's a huge constituency out there that if you bag the ideology for a while and just talk about the issues, you could have a winning strategy.
No, and I think you can see that with Governor Warner in Virginia, where he went out of office with 80% approval, which, you know, as a red state and a Democrat, having 80% approval as a governor is unheard of. And he did that by focusing on pragmatic, without ideology. He was very pragmatic about his agenda and was basically solving the problems.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I think the big question is in addition to the competence issues, which Republicans are failing at dramatically, but at the end of the day, people want to see contrast, right? They want to be able to know what exactly are my choices. And Democrats have been so afraid in a lot of ways to really stand up for what they believe in, because they've internalized this notion that the Americans are becoming more conservative, when it's really actually not very true, that they're afraid to really clearly state what they believe in. The American people don't do nuance. So we can't sit there and try to nuance our way into power, which is what Democrats try to do. We need to make it very stark and very clear what the differences are, and it can be done. And once that's done, I think people will, you know, we may not win every race in every state and every district, but at least people will understand what the choices really are, which is not the case right now.
Yeah, because the problem with the Democrats running on nuance and running for a slim majority is that it's not going to change the dynamics of this country, where the conservatives have a strong foothold, and right now they're the dominant majority with the trifecta hold on power. So if the Democrats just win with a slim majority, you know, one of the bodies of Congress, or they happen to win in 2008, but by, you know, winning Ohio or Florida this time, it's not going to really change the dynamics of the country. What we have to do is go out into all the states and campaign as a national party and to rebuild the brand of the party in so many of these rural areas where Democrats have given up.
Well, it's not like there isn't some major issues here. In November, we will decide whether we do have democratic opposition or are a one-party state, whether we stand for war or peace, for preemption over prevention, whether we're a Christian nation or a secular democracy, whether we're a constitutional republic or a corporate empire.
And if the Democrats drew those sort of distinctions going into the election and they won, then it would be very clear to point towards why the Democrats won. As we're going right now, we're basically hoping that the culture of corruption of the Republican Party is enough to disgust the voters into either not showing up or pulling the lever for the Democratic Party. But all it's going to gain is a simple majority after November if we really haven't run on anything.
Yeah, I don't think there's a single consultant in D.C. that would take what you just said right now. Very stark distinctions. And,
right.
And advise a candidate to speak that clearly. And I think that's one of the problems.
Well, thanks for joining us.
So
we will follow on the discussion. And I thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Marcos Melitzis, who was the founder of the Daily Kos, which is one of the biggest blogs, websites in the country with 1 million hits a day, and his co-author, Jerome Armstrong, of their new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. This program is produced by Lewis Vandenberg. Jazz Shepherd is the engineer. Rusty Wynn is the associate producer. Carol Coote is the assistant producer. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.